Thank you for listening to Ivy Podcast, where we feature weekly leadership conversations with thought leaders and industry experts. Now, here is your host, Cesar Romero.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Ivy Podcast, the podcast for leaders, innovators, and entrepreneurs. I'm your host, Cesar Romero, and today we're going to talk about how solving your own frustrations can lead to becoming an entrepreneur with Jody Frank, founder and CEO of Culinear. Jody was inspired to develop Culinear by her challenges around locating and managing recipes. Driven by her entrepreneurial spirit, she soon identified a much larger opportunity to fill a sizable void in the American marketplace. Jody envisions Culinear as an innovative and flexible solution that empowers people everywhere to not only share recipes, but create homemade food and positively impact both individual and community health. In this episode, we'll dive deeper into Jody's entrepreneurial journey, from her biggest lessons to how to attract the right talent for your startup, into how her frustration with food deserts and digital recipes led her to start Culinear, the importance of mentors, and why selling is one of the most important skills that you can develop for your career. And before we dive into today's episode, I want to ask you for a favor, especially if you find this episode valuable. Leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. Just search for Ivy Podcast or click the link in the show notes. This would really help us reach more listeners and expand our impact. Thank you so much for the support. And now let's dive right into the show. Hi, Jody. Thank you so much for coming to the Ivy Podcast. It's a pleasure to have you. And I am excited to dive deeper into your entrepreneurial journey with Culinear and get to learn more about your background and what your vision is for Culinear. So thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you, Cesar. I'm really glad to be here and talk to you about my journey. It's been a really long, windy path. So hopefully others will find a nugget or two that they can take away.
Absolutely. And with that in mind, let's kick it off with, for those that might not be familiar with your work, tell us a bit more about your background and how you got to Culinear.
So, like I said, I have a really long, windy path. I'm on career number four. So I've had four very distinct career chapters, if you will. So to start with, I grew up outside of Pittsburgh, and I was the first in my family to go to college, got into middle of my senior year, and I said to my parents, I'm planning to go to college. Oh, really? And they had no plans for this. This just wasn't even on the radar because people just went to work. And so my dad heard it. He worked at Westinghouse Bettis, and he heard that Pitt Johnstown was a really good school. So I applied and I went there, period. It was no like it is today where you go do all these college tours, try to figure out what you want to be when you grow up. And I started as a biology major because that was the only class I really liked in high school. So anyhow, I went to Pitt Johnstown, graduated from Pitt Johnstown, ended up in DC right after because the job market was not so good in the Pittsburgh area. And had a couple jobs there and eventually got recruited to my first career job, which was Bristol Myers Squibb. It was actually Mead Johnson Nutritionals, which is a Bristol Myers division. And I was very, very fortunate to get that job because A, it was one of the hot jobs to get in the day. Like right now, I think being an entrepreneur or getting some job at Google is, but back then getting a job in one of the better pharmaceutical companies was like what everybody wanted. So I got there and I'm really, really fortunate because I had a great boss who gave me a really good vision of what it's like to lead people. And he was a great mentor as well. And I also got great training. I don't know that corporations invest in people the way I was invested in. And it was really, really set me on a path toward what I am today.
Let me pause there because I'm interested in this. What was it about this mentor, this training that set you up for success and that you still apply those lessons to this
day? It's a good question. So I'm glad you asked that. I didn't know how deep to go into. I'm glad to talk about this. So with Bristol Myers, when you were hired as a field representative, we had a year-long training program. You'd go out for a week. You'd learn about product. You'd learn about nutrition, infant nutrition and adult nutrition. And you'd learn how to sell. And the selling skills are top-notch. So it's about asking a lot of questions and getting a lot of feedback and positioning a solution that meets the needs of the customer and their patients, because they were doctors.
Great skill sets to develop.
Great skills to develop. And when you do that early in your career, it kind of like that sets the tone for everything you do in life. And we did this. So we did a week. You come back, you'd work side by side with another rep and with your manager in the field, making sure that you're doing things right. Then you go out for 2 weeks, and this is a back and forth for a whole year. And even after 5 years of training, we went back for what we called retread. And that company back then, we had a national sales manager. It was nothing about selling. It was nothing about business. It was about work-life balance, taking care of your body because you're in a car all the time. We were, at the time, I was lifting. It was crazy. I have 4-inch stiletto heels on, and I'd be carrying around formula cases and samples because that's what we did back then. We dressed up like really to the nines, and we'd go visit the doctors. And in those days, the pharmaceutical industry and the physicians had a different relationship. Now it's, you know, very, there's a buffer. You're not allowed to do this. You're not allowed to do that, because unfortunately the pharmaceutical industry over the years took advantage of that relationship and made it uncomfortable. So they were kind of shut out. But back then it was really freaking awesome. It was really, really awesome. So during this time, I mean, so that's what it was. And my mentor, Rich DeBone, he was just this guy that was like a no-nonsense kind of guy. I should shut those off. I'll never forget this one thing. He took over a district, and there was like 10 representatives in the Baltimore region, which is how I ended up in Harrisburg. They moved me to Harrisburg. And they were all older, and, you know, there was some WIC contracts, which means they were shut out of hospitals and stuff because there's a lot of WIC patients. And every meeting, it'd be wine. We can't do this. We can't do this. And I remember one meeting, we're all sitting around in a U-shape, and he gave pieces of paper. He said, I want you to write everything that's frustrating you down on a piece of paper. Put in this basket, and everybody's feverishly writing in their all, you know, all their frustrations. And he took that basket and he threw it in the trash. He said, now let's move forward with what we can do. And that region went from bottom of the barrel to top in the country because of his leadership. And that stuck with me. I mean, that's like 30 some years ago, right?
It's so important to have mentors and leaders that take the time to nurture that leadership mindset in you. In sales, it's one of the best skills that you can learn, right?
Yeah.
Doesn't matter what industry, everybody needs good salespeople.
Yeah. Right?
And the fact that you learned that very early on in your career, it's awesome, right? Because nowadays, I don't know, people are a little bit scared of sales, or they don't think of sales as a skill set that they can develop, right? But
it's true.
Anyone needs sales, right? Any startup, any big company, whether you're a big company or a startup, sales is an important skill set.
It is. And you know what, then to take that further, the experience. So I was recruited out of the DC area where I'd moved to move into Harrisburg, which is just north of Baltimore, because that was the territory that he wanted me to be in. And I was calling on tertiary care centers, which is like where residents do their training and so forth. And the sickest of the sick kids go. So babies that are born with these disorders. So I was there, and I got to meet and work with some of these top doctors. And this made me realize why it's important to be humble. Because, you know, I could go around thinking I'm the number one sales rep, or I'm the number four sales rep, or whatever, for this huge mega corporation. But then you meet this guy who's changing the life of babies and making the world a better place. And he's humble. And I'm like, Okay. And women too. I mean, there was a woman out of Seattle that I drove around speaker. We were sponsoring her speaking and I got to know her. She was the most down to earth person. And she was literally changing infant mm-hmm. lives. It's really cool.
Yeah, it is. It's important to be humble, right? Because no matter what, there's always going to be someone more successful than you.
You can always learn from somebody else.
You can always learn from somebody else. And you can also help people that are getting started on their journey,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Now let's fast forward a little bit here to Collinear.
Okay.
I want to make sure we dive into your entrepreneurial journey. What was the moment where you decided, you know, there's something here with Collinear? Or I guess to start off, let's explain to our audience what Collinear is, and then let's dive into how did that all come about?
Yeah. Okay. So Collinear is a social platform and marketplace mm-hmm. for people who love to cook. Mm-hmm. And it's different than what's been delivered to the marketplace before in that a lot of the things that have been offered to help people save time or get inspired are either prepackaged or disconnected from the daily life of the user. So it might be like on a grocery store app or mm-hmm. on a food blog, but not very accessible when needed to the everyday user every day. Mm-hmm. So it's a social platform for users who love to cook and for food brands who want to build community around their brand. Mm-hmm. And it's exciting because nobody's done anything quite like this. The way I got here is really windy weavy. So I left Bristol Myers and I taught at the community college while I was raising my kids. Mm-hmm. I did that because I just had trouble with work-life balance. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, after a certain amount of time, I'm like, I'm not making enough money. So I went back to pharma. Mm-hmm. The industry had changed. I left and I started a franchise that got me into safety industry. Mm-hmm. So I had like a 10-year stint in safety with my own business. And then I worked for 3M. And then I took a job with a small company and things were going south. I was recruited away from 3M as a sales rep. Mm-hmm. And I had already left my business because I didn't enjoy being a distributor. Mm-hmm. So I went to 3M and then I was recruited to this smaller company. I'm like, oh, this will be good. Cause it's like being my own boss. Cause I was supposed to grow the region and, right. and grow my team. And I'm mm-hmm. like, I like that. Mm-hmm. And not such big corporate and yet it's not my money. So I don't have to worry about the cash flow. And so I took this job. I was like, okay, I'm going to do this. I think it'll be really fun and it'll mm-hmm. be a great new chapter. And then as soon as I got there, within a month, we found out the whole sales team that my boss had just put together, found out that this company was in bankruptcy court mm-hmm. and up for auction and that the C-suite was crooked. Mm-hmm. And we were all like, oh my gosh. So while we were in bankruptcy court and up for auction, there was like nothing for me to do. I mean, how can mm-hmm. I grow distribution and hire people, right? We don't even know who's going to own us.
Yeah.
So he said, just hold your breath, I guess, you know? And I had this idea for Collinear, the seed of it back 10 years prior to this. I just wanted to be able to take my recipes, take a picture of it and convert it to a digital file and organize my recipes so they were with me all the time. Mm-hmm. Now, if I had tried to do that when I first had the idea, I probably couldn't have because data science hadn't evolved to the point where it is now. Mm-hmm. So the timing was kind of right. Data mm-hmm. science was coming up and I had time to work on it. So I started to dig. I started to figure out like, what's it take? Who do I need to get involved? How is software built? I really didn't even know. But I figured it out. It took me longer than it would have if I had already been in that industry. I could have mm-hmm. got this ramped up faster. But during that process, all this corporate background, I have 3M, Bristol Myers, I worked in an academics, you know, I've got like critical thinking. Mm-hmm. First, I had to make sure, is this a thing that's worth going after?
Right.
And second of all, what's the business opportunity? So I did a lot of research and I started to uncover a lot about the food industry that made me pivot even early on and make it a larger scope than I originally thought. Originally, it's going to be just a recipe app. Mm-hmm. But that's when I realized, kind of like Elon Musk said, figured out with the electric car, you can't just put electric car out there without causing a systemic solution. Mm-hmm. We can't solve what's going on in the kitchen at home for recipes and making homemade food that matters to people without connecting the pieces of getting ingredients and sharing with friends and family, because that's all part of what they need to do.
So let me pause here, because I think it's interesting that Collinear, the core of it, the inception, was because you had this need, this pain point, that you wanted to have your own platform or your own app where you could take pictures and collect your recipes. And that's awesome. And the reason I'm bringing that up, because one of the best ways to become an entrepreneur is to what they call scratch your own itch, right? And you and you did that, right? And it's taking you down this rabbit hole. And I want to dive into some of your findings about the food industry. You know, what were some of the unexpected findings throughout your research that made you even commit even more to making Collinear a success?
Yeah. When I was at the community college, I learned that I'm a system thinker. I'm a mm-hmm. system problem solver. I could tell that story. It's a different story. It's not worth pursuing right now, but there's some things that happened post-World War II mm-hmm. that, and think about it, that's not that long ago. Okay. Mm-hmm. So that's like one person's lifetime.
Yeah.
That completely turned how we cook upside down on its head. Mm-hmm. It was like this perfect storm. So one, the government was incentivizing farmers to monofarm, mm-hmm. to monocrop. So, you know, grow crops. Well, and if it's all the same, we're going to incentivize you to do that. Mm-hmm. So we got away from what we call regenerative or sustainable farming. Mm-hmm. And that resulted in a lot of problems in and of itself, because now we're moving down towards industrial farming. At the same time, grocery stores became, you know, large grocery stores started to bubble up. So what you need there is you need shelf stable food. So you grow crops that are shelf stable, you promote products in the store that are shelf stable, and you start to have less variety. Mm-hmm. Furthermore, it's because it's around profit centers, these are big corporations. We're not going to put a grocery store in this neighborhood because it's not profitable. Mm. So then we have food deserts in cities and in very rural areas. And I there's a lot going on in the world right now, in ag tech, in grocery tech, food tech, to try to reverse this. But I think we can be a big part of that. Because without consumer demand for locally grown products, mm-hmm. no one's really going to do it.
Right.
And I think that we can't solve the whole systemic problem, but we can be a big piece of it just by providing technology that helps people easily make homemade food from sources and products that are grown mostly local.
Let's dive deeper into that. So what is the big vision for Collinear, the 3 to 5 year vision, and what sets Collinear apart from other similar platforms out there?
So my vision is that, and this is bold, but I really expect us to be like the app that people think of when they think of anything for cooking.
Bold is good.
Bold is good.
Yes.
And you know what? I'm not afraid to tackle it, but bold is good. So I think that we can do this because, and this is why I asked the why, like what makes it different. Mm-hmm. So everything else that's out there is either I'm going to give you a bunch of recipe ideas to inspire you and make you see this ad, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
From the publishers or on Instagram, the same thing, or any social media really.
We're bombarded by ads.
Right. And on the other hand, you have recipes being used by grocery stores or blah, 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 blah. It's mm-hmm. everywhere. So mm-hmm. we know recipes sell product. But what's missing, and I think you and I talked about this before, what's really missing is that connection, that authentic connection to your food. We're kind of whitewashing that and losing it. And we can provide the platform to make that grow again and find people like you that like your type of food, maybe your heritage or your culture or the region of the country or world that you live in. Mm-hmm. Everybody eats differently. It's very, very personal.
Yeah.
And we all love to talk about it. Oh my gosh, my grandmother made XYZ. And then the other person's like, oh, I love that. That's what Culinaire does that the other apps don't do.
I love that. It just reminded me one of my mentors and my current boss, I guess, Eric Martin. He collects old church cookbooks. And I was just like, I didn't even know there was such a thing as church cookbooks.
Yeah.
But it's a communal thing with food and the recipes. And, you know, my grandmother used to make this. So yeah,
that's exactly what we're doing. And then the business model. So, you know, that's one part of it. That's an important part of it because once we have that community and we have those engaged users and we're solving those problems, then we're also becoming a really great place for food brands. And what we're doing there is different too.
Right.
So rather than just selling ads, we're going to sell a SaaS platform, sell a subscription so they can build a community because food brands will spend anywhere from $500 to a couple $1,000s to have an Instagram or a social media person put a recipe out for a couple weeks.
Right.
And then it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not really any great way to track the results anyway. So what if we take this platform, we sell SaaS platform, and we say, okay, you're subscribed month over month and you're going to get X amount of exposure, X number of sponsorships in our email, which by the way, we get a 24 to 58% open rate, which is huge.
Yeah.
So, you know, we'll sponsor that. We're going to highlight your brand on our homepage, all these things that we can do to build community for the brand, and your recipes are evergreen. So those recipes that you had a recipe creator make for you, they stay on the platform until you cancel your subscription. So your customers can find them all the time. It's just a better way. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to some food brands about it. They love it. And I've talked to, I'm working on getting CSAs, community shared agriculture, going back to like buy local. I have 10 that have signed up and we're going to keep getting more and more and more and more. So the brands love this. The people love it. The creators love it because they're going to be able to make money as well. And it's just going to be a more authentic connection to brands, people, and family and loved ones.
And that's the key, authentic connections, whether you're a person or a business, that is the unfair advantage.
I hope you're right.
it's very underrated, but it's there. And
the thing with that is like, there was a company, and I don't want to give them any credibility, but I don't want to give them any promotion, but there's a big, big company that I had been working with before they really went into the consumer app space, and they kind of knocked off our IP, I think. I'm not 100% sure, but it looks a lot like what I showed them. And it's not authentic, so it doesn't resonate. Mm-hmm. Like I noticed a dropping in the rankings. They spent a lot of money to get up in the App Store rankings, and I noticed they're dropping like by 20, 50, 60, boom, 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 because it's a lot of content, but not a lot of authenticity.
Yeah. Now, Julie, let's shift gears into lessons that you've learned throughout your entrepreneurial journey. Like, what are some of the things that you, I guess, have done wrong and learned from? And what are some of the things that you did right from the beginning?
Well, lessons learned, I would say the biggest lesson I learned is that entering the whole startup environment has been a lesson learned. It's way different than the rest of the business world. The priorities are different. The pace is different. The language is different. So I had to learn all of that. Even in the dev world, I learned a lot about development. I know a lot of business people don't, but I felt like I needed to be able to speak my developer's language. I don't need to know how to code, but I need to know what they're talking about when they speak. Same with investors. Like things like traction and stories aren't exactly what I thought traction and stories meant. And so I've learned that those are hard lessons. I think that's a huge one too for startup, for founders who come from corporate and go into the startup world, is understanding what investors mean by traction and what they mean by in your pitch has to tell a good story. I used to spend a lot of time talking about the consumer problem and they don't want to hear about that. They want to know what the business story is like. How are you going to grow your business and how have you proven that you can grow it and those things. So it's a different story than I thought they wanted to know.
I love that you have learned this by being in the arena and not being one of the spectators on the sideline. Like you just jump right into it and you're learning as you go. And that's one of the best ways to learn. Like just start doing things.
Yeah, it's hard.
No, it's definitely hard. now in terms of the team, right? How big is the team and how, what was your thinking process in putting together the team? What do you look for in potential teammates or co-founders? What's your process behind that?
Well, at first I just wanted people that I could do the job, right? Mm-hmm. Like somebody who could develop. I didn't even know what I needed. Mm-hmm. And I went through Ben Franklin Technology Techcelerator, which is Pennsylvania's tech startup program. And if I didn't hear it once, I heard it 5,000 times if you found your technical co-founder yet. And I'm like, you just don't go out and pick one up off the shelf.
Right.
You know, it's like, it was the most frustrating question. It was like, don't even talk to me until you have a technical co-founder. I'm like, okay. There's other ways to do this. So I networked a lot and I found the first tech person, he's a co-founder, but I mean, I'm a founder with a team of co-founders that sort of share in the equity, but they came on part-time as a side hustle because one of the things that, you know, it's a joke to developers that business people have this great idea and I'm going to give you equity if you come on board with me, because they get that pitch like every
all
week.
All the time. Yeah. Every week. Hey, I got this idea. I'll give you equity.
It's like, well, I can't pay the bills with equity, right?
Yep. Yeah. It's a reality.
Yeah. So, but what I did is I found some people that were really ambitious and really smart and experienced. Like my first partner, Mike.
Okay. Let me pause there. So what was your pitch to these people that joined Codineer? I'm curious.
Well, so I did a lot of networking and this one guy, he must have seen me talk to people like 10 times. He's like, you know, I think I know somebody you might want to talk to. Mm-hmm. He's a really good cook. And I think he made a recipe app before. And he introduced me to him. So I reached out to him on LinkedIn. And we had a conversation on LinkedIn back and forth. And then we met at a coffee shop in Harrisburg. Mm-hmm. And I said, so do you want to help me? And he goes, okay. So he's turned out to be the best person I could have ever found, because he's not a like a tech leader. He's told me he's an unknown managed people. I just want to code, but he's so smart. He's got tons of experience in building backend databases. And I realized that that's more important, but it's super important.
Yeah.
As important, at least as a front end. He's been really solid with that. And he teaches at Penn State. He has a full-time job. And I just found out he's working with a couple other startups too. I'm like, dang, dude, you got a lot going on. And he never drops a ball. Never drops the ball. Yeah. And then, from there, it was like finding a front-end developer, right? And finding someone who could be a lead. And I have that personnel too. That was painful because I went through a couple of these like temp. I don't want to like Upwork or, you know, and I had one really bad hire. Mm-hmm. And then I had another one that wasn't as bad, but wasn't good either. And then I'm so frustrated because I'm spending all this money and time.
Yeah.
And we're not getting where we need to be. And I've got this back-end developer who's brilliant, but the front-end developer's dropping the ball. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones I'm paying. Mm-hmm. And so I just did like a Google search. We're building in React Native. And I did this Google search and I was like React Native developers. And I found this school called Handlebar. Mm-hmm. And I reached out to the guy who runs it. And I said, do you ever have people looking for jobs? And he put me out on a job board and I got all these resumes from around the world, like literally from all around the world. I was like, holy. And I, as you know, it's so funny, Caesar, I never have trouble finding people to work on this project. I have trouble having money to pay them. A lot of people, yeah, it's a problem. there's a lot of people that want to work on this. They love what we're working. It's so cool. It's like, that's inspiring to me. Mm-hmm. Like people will come back to me after I don't hire them, say, hey, are you hiring again? And I'm like, wow. So I found this guy. I whittled it down to two. I wanted to be in the same time zone for mm-hmm. meeting sakes.
Yeah.
And I found these two guys, one in New York and one in Brazil. And Mike helped me interview them. And he wanted to go with a guy in New York. And then that guy in New York got like flaky. I was like, oh, this is not good. Mm-hmm. So I went with a guy in Brazil who I really had a genuine, like, you know, you just kind of sixth sense, you know, someone's a good guy, good egg.
You feel it.
Yeah.
In your core.
Yeah. So that's what he was like. Mm-hmm. And he's been a godsend. It took him a year to clean up all the mess, mm-hmm. but we launched last June. And now I would say we launched an MVP in June. We've got some beta users mm-hmm. and now we're like ready to roll. I mean, we're ready to go.
Yeah.
And he also brought on a part-time person in Brazil to help, but
yeah.
It's so funny. He's a half a world. He's a world away. Mm-hmm. Literally. He's on the other side mm-hmm. of the world and he's half my age, mm-hmm. different cultures.
Yeah.
We think alike.
That's awesome. It's so important when you're hiring, right? To sell them on your vision, to think alike. Not exactly the same, right? Because you want someone right. that challenges your assumptions, your ideas, but having the same values and align in the priorities.
Yeah.
And everybody knows this, right? But hiring is one of the most challenging but important things you could do for any project, right? Especially mm-hmm. startups.
Yep. And so you asked me like what my values, like what do we look for? I kind of wrote this down just so I know. Above all, trust. Because I did hire people I couldn't trust.
Mm-hmm. So let me pause there. Trust. How do you pick it up? How do you know that you can trust a person? What are some of the signs that you look for?
So initially, it's tough. You have to go with your gut. And mm-hmm. I've learned when hiring developers and probably anybody mm-hmm. that you do a test project first.
Yeah.
And see how they do. And it'll help you with the skills, but also see how they work and how they respond. Mm-hmm. Or are they concerned about doing a good job? Mm-hmm. That type of stuff. And over time, as you give more access to all your ins and outs of the company, you know, you want to make sure that somebody is going to be trustworthy. So
yeah.
it's through the experience and the interactions that you have and things that they'll bring up, like, hey, I was really thinking about this and I was concerned because of this, that, or the other thing. Mm-hmm. And whether it be, you know, a customer experience or whether it be what's good for the company or right. even for me, like mm-hmm. there have been a lot of developers, they never even asked me one time, hey, how is your day? Mm-hmm. You know, it's always like
simple things.
This is me and this is me.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it is simple things. And thing is, we don't want anybody with big egos. That's just not healthy.
Egos, it's mm-hmm. always an issue. And I wish more companies did test projects. The hiring process can take so long, like the traditional hiring process, you know, between 1 month to 6-7 weeks. And I'm like, why don't you just give this person a test project? See how they perform.
Right? Pay them for it.
Sure.
Yeah.
Pay them for it. But you're going to find out more things about their performance than just their resume or the interview process. So I think that's yep. genius. The fact that you do these mini trials.
Yeah.
You know, with your teammates to
especially when you're remote. You know.
Especially when you're remote. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, that's awesome. So definitely do trials, people, especially if you want to find out if you can trust the performance.
I asked a friend of mine who works for a big healthcare company. He runs a big software development department for mm-hmm. a big healthcare company. Mm-hmm. And he's kind of giving me some insights here and there. And I said to him, so how do you know if the person that you're hiring can do what they say they can do?
Mm.
Good and question. This is a big company, right? He said, oh, you can't.
Hmm.
And I was like, so what do you do? They can absorb that. I can't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like a small company can't start up.
That's, that's so true. Now, Jody, you're a woman entrepreneur. What advice will you have for other women entrepreneurs out there, or maybe they are already on their journey in entrepreneurship, or maybe they're thinking about it, and maybe they have that same itch that you had over many years ago with cutting hair? What will be your recommendation to them? What advice could you give them?
Things are getting better for women entrepreneurs. It's funny, I've always been in a man's world. Mm-hmm. Pharmaceuticals was dominantly male when I was joined. Safety was dominantly male. I've never really felt that I was in a position where I was not taken seriously until I was in this role.
Mm.
And it happened several times, and it stunned me because I've never, I mean, you kind of know when you're in a big corporation and this is going on, but it never affected me.
Mm-hmm.
It did affect me quite a bit. It actually made me quite upset. It was like, mm-hmm. I was angry because I was at a startup. It was at a pitch competition, and it was just like a practice one, really. It wasn't, there was some angel investors there and to get feedback. And I noticed, not so much when I was pitching, but when all the other women in the room were pitching, that the questions being asked of them were different. Like they'd be framed like, you can't do that. Hmm. Or where the guys would be like, how are you going to do that?
Hmm.
And big then difference. They would, big difference. Mm-hmm. And it tells you about the mindset, right?
Yeah.
We're assuming you can't, and we're assuming you can.
Uh-huh.
So I would say find connections. There's a lot of investors. There's a lot of other founders, a lot of networks. There's a lot of community being built to support women founders so that doesn't pull you down. Cause it could really quickly, if you're not strong and you don't have a really good, strong backbone, you'd be like, I'm done. I can't do this. You'll believe them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So I think that's the key, is finding, and not just women, you got to find allies through. And I would say this for people of color too. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't just be relying on each other because you're just speaking to yourselves and no change is going to be made. We have to involve men in the conversation. And most men that do this don't even know they're doing it. It's not that they're intentionally doing it. Mm-hmm. It's just like built into their subconscious.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a systemic issue, right? But I think it's so important, especially for women and minorities, to find those allies, find the group of supporters, much like yourself. You know, that's what you've been doing, networking and finding people that align with your values, with what you're trying to build. Because when the times get tough, those people are going to motivate you to continue on that journey. So that's a very great advice. Awesome, Jody. Well, to wrap it up, I always like to ask my guests about books. And I see that you have a bookshelf in the background. And I wanted to ask you about your favorite books, like your top three. Maybe these are books that you have gifted to other people, or they have had a profound influence in your work and personal life. And I wanted to ask you if you can share with us what those books are.
So those are big books behind me. Some of them I've read, some of them I've read chapters, some of them are novels. I love, from a novel perspective, David McCullough's John Adams.
Mm-hmm.
It's historical novel. That was probably the best written book I ever read. From a business perspective, The Fred Factor.
Never heard of that.
Have you read that?
No.
And
I love when I discover new books.
Yeah, it's old. It's been around for a long time. It's about a mailman and how he brought great customer service to on his journey every day.
I love that.
Yeah, yeah.
People say,
I'll send it to you.
I'd love to read. Like, I don't know if you can see it, but my bookshelf's in the back. It's a tiny one. I need to upgrade it. But
I have so many more books. I could send you more.
But when people say, oh, that book is old, or that book came out many years ago, it doesn't really matter to me, because information, right, the principles of success, right, they're timeless.
Yeah.
Right. So whether the book came out this year or it came out hundreds of years ago, if it has timeless principles, it still applies to this day. So it gets me excited.
And the one I read when I was early in my startup journey was Peter Thiel's 0 to 1.
A
developer told me to read it. And I was like,
yeah,
this is where I came up with Habib. I want to talk about, you can't, because I had in my head that we had to solve something complete, 0 to 1. And not just a slice of the person's day. It had to connect all the dots. We don't have to recreate all that, but we have to connect it. Mm-hmm. And that book really helped me frame that. I think it's really important. I think people should read that book. Now, who inspires me the most? It's not a book, but when I was teaching at community college, I'm really inspired by Edward Deming and the Deming principles of continuous improvement.
Edward Deming, I need to look this up.
Yeah. Yeah, you do. 360 improvement or continuous improvement. Mm-hmm. Really?
Continuous improvement.
Yeah.
That's the secret.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know that he has a book, but he's well written. You can find stuff from him.
Awesome, Yoni. Well, to wrap it up, what would be your number one takeaway for, and I know we already mentioned this, but I always like to leave the audience with one takeaway that they can absorb, either from your entrepreneurial journey or your career? What is one lesson that you wouldn't get tired of repeating over and over again that our audience can take away from?
Okay, so I had a different answer that wasn't exactly for that question in my mind that I was gonna tell you. I can reframe it though. So we can't package solutions and have a silver bullet for systemic problems. I mean, big complex problems aren't going to be solved by putting something in a box or with one shot. You have to look at the system and figure out how the interactions work. I hope that didn't come through. I'll say it again. How the pieces fit together and solve them systemically. It's the same with healthcare. Mm-hmm. It's the same with a lot of our, a lot of our major issues in this world,
Love that.
Yeah.
Understand first, understand how everything works. And then from there, come up with potential solutions.
We live in a soundbite society, unfortunately. People don't have the patience to understand fully.
Yeah. It's an instant gratification society.
Yeah. And that's not going to, nothing we do that will seem like a quick fix is actually going to fix.
I agree with you 100%. Awesome, Jody. Well, it's been a pleasure to have you on the podcast. I'm excited to follow your entrepreneurial journey, see where Culinear takes off. And I'm just inspired by our conversation. So
thank you.
Definitely wish you the best of luck. And I'm really looking forward to having you on the show later down the road to get an update on Culinear.
It'd be wonderful.
And but for now, I want to thank you. And I'll see you down the road.
You're so easy to talk to. I enjoyed it so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Ivy Podcast. Be sure to subscribe to our RSS feed on ivypodcast.com and all major podcasting platforms like Spotify and iTunes. As always, if you enjoyed this podcast, please give us a rating on iTunes.